email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yesterday we were talking about spelling and the words we found hard to spell. Colette said medicine is the one that she always has to check. Paul said strict was his bugbear when it came to misspelling. Then we had a science teacher on who could never spell equipment. And somebody else said the trickiest word for them was occurrence, two C's and two R's. So what makes words so hard to spell? Well, Professor David Crystal has written over 100 books. He's a linguist. One of the books he's written is Spell It Out, The Singular Story of English Spelling. And David joins us now. Hello, David.
Hello, Ray. Yeah. Some nice examples there.
Yeah,
thanks, already.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to this chat. You're the man I've been looking for 20 years, David. I don't know if you know this.
No, I hadn't noticed, but I'm glad you found me now. Yeah. How can I help you, Ray?
Well, firstly, let's get to the current problem, which is misspelling and why it happens and why particular words prove problematic for people.
Well, it's all to do with the history of English, of course, or the history of almost any language. I mean, you could say the same about Irish and Welsh and all sorts of things. But with English, we've got a particular problem. When it started, you know, back in Old English times, Anglo-Saxon times, 1,000 years ago, it was pretty regular. You know, for every sound, there was a letter and you knew where you were. And then, you know, your history, 1066 and all that, along come the French and they beat us up. And then their scribes started to change the spelling to make it more Frenchified. Mm. And that made it a bit more complicated. And then there were other problems later in the history of the language. And each sort of century brought a new layer of difficulty onto English spelling. And so we end up with this sort of messy situation we have today.
There's nobody in charge, David, really, is there?
Absolutely not. I mean, there was an attempt to do so back in the 18th century. And you know, over the years, people have said, let's have an academy or something like that to sort it all out. But the problem with English, you see, is that it became a global language. And as soon as it did that, different countries decided to go their own way. And the biggest thing, of course, is America versus Britain. You know, you know the problem here. How do you spell colour? Mm. Well, C-O-L-O-U-R or C-O-L-O-R. And that all started in the 18th century and now is massive because of the influence of American English. A lot of those American spellings have now started to influence British spelling. So the situation's got even more complicated.
Because if you were starting from scratch, which is an impossibility, you would standardise things, wouldn't you? You would have certain rules. And from those rules, you would be able to work out any spelling.
Yeah, you would indeed. It'd be a so-called phonetic spelling. For every one sound, there'd be a letter. But there's a problem here, Ray, and that's the difference of different accents from one part of the world to another. Now, I'm speaking to you from Wales, but just over the border in England, there are lots of people who don't pronounce the R after a vowel, whereas in Irish English and Welsh English and so on, we do. So how do you spell words that end in a letter R? You see, it would vary enormously. So there have been lots of proposals for spelling reform to try and standardise the situation. None have ever been successful because just imagine, say tomorrow somebody waved a magic wand and everything became nice and regular in spelling. Mm. You wouldn't be able to read any of the books of the past.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and that's been the difficulty.
Yeah. We've got all the bad habits and we need them to be able to read, is what you're saying in a way.
Yes. Once you've taken the trouble to learn to spell, then you're very reluctant to let it go. You know, you've spent all that time in school and elsewhere doing your best and probably succeeding quite well on the whole. All right, there are a few words, as you mentioned, that people find difficult. But on the whole, it's not too bad. And once you've done all that work, you don't want to let it go.
No. How many words are there in the English language?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows. The long answer is, well, if you go to the big Oxford English Dictionary, there are 750,000 words in that. But if you go to an American dictionary, there is another 750,000, and they're not all the same. So we're talking about at least 1,000,000 words, and probably more when you go around the world to all the different dialects that there are.
A recurring thing yesterday was that, like, occurrence, the two C's and the two R's. And I was saying that when I have to write commitment, you know, I I know there's two M's, but is there two T's? You know, and there's a lot of words like that, accommodation. And why did they come about in the first place? Because they don't actually make any sense to me, David.
Now, this is all because of where the words come from. You know, one of the best ways of approaching spelling is to remember that every word has its own story. Every word has a history. And if you take the trouble, if you've got a really difficult word that always bugs you, to follow up its history, and you can do this online easily. You go to a big site like the OxfordEnglishDictionary.com or somewhere like that, and you follow the story of it, you'll realize why the word is as it is. In the case of words like commitment, it's all to do with the history of the word coming from the Latin language, you know, centuries ago, and where, how there were two M's that had to come forward, otherwise people would say you were spelling wrongly. Now, when people have a difficult word like this, do your best to try and think of a mnemonic, a little reminder as to how the word is. I'll give you an example, Ray.
Right, okay.
You know, a very common one is people don't know how to spell the word stationary. You know, stationary meaning a car is stopped, or stationary meaning your letters that you write.
Right.
Okay? Now, is it A-R-Y at the end?
Or E-R-Y.
E-R-Y at the end. And people have a trouble with it. Well, here's a way that will mean you'll never forget it again. Stationary cars. There's a letter A in cars, isn't there?
Yes, yes.
So stationary. Stationary letters. There's an E in letters, isn't there?
Yeah.
Stationary. You'll never forget that now.
I feel like I'm back in first class. I'm 6 years old. But
well, you're doing very well, Ray. And
thank you very much, sir.
Let you off homework
thank
tonight.
Thank you very much, sir. No, the reason I've been looking for you for 20 years is this question, and I don't know if you have the answer. Why do certain areas have certain accents? We know they exist, but why do they form in the first place?
It's all to do with identity. There have always been accents in language right from the very beginning. There are two drivers that force language along. One is the need for intelligibility. We have to understand each other. But the other big driver is we have to show everybody where we're from, because community is so important. And accent is the best badge of community that we've got. Because think about it. If you wanted to show you were Irish, say, or I wanted to show I was Welsh, how would you do it? Well, you could do it by dressing in a certain way or wearing a big badge saying, I am from Ireland or something like that. But you have to buy your badge and or whatever, or your clothes. And in any case, you can't see them in the dark. Now, there's only one thing that you can perceive in the dark as well as in the light, and that's your voice.
Yes.
And so an accent developed in order to express the identity of a group.
Mm.
And of course, in any language, there are hundreds of accents, sometimes just down the road, you know.
Because I went to, like, I don't know if you have this in the UK, but we have townies here. So I come from a town called Kildare. Population when I was growing up, about 6,000. When we went to secondary school, lads came from out the country, you know, from rural parts.
Yeah.
And their accent, although they were only 5 miles away, was completely different to ours.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it needn't be even 5 miles.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain places in the UK. There's a little town called Welshpool on the border between England and Wales. And I went there to study the accent once upon a time. And on either side of the main street, there's a difference in accent. On the Welsh side, they speak in a Welshish sort of way, and on the English side, they speak in a sort of Gloucestershire way with an R.
Okay,
and all that sort
I get that it's part of your identity. And back before, you know, we could read and all that sort of thing, our ancestors, this was a way of telling who was one of yours. That's fair enough.
Yeah, that's it.
But I want to go one step back again, and I'm wondering why. You know, like I was saying, sort of. I wasn't serious, but I was going, like, in here in Ireland, I'm from the Midlands, which is flat, and all the accents are flat. Now, that's probably coincidental. Whereas the topography is more mountainous, there's more of an up and down sort of a lilt. Is there anything in that at all?
No, not really, because there are lots of examples. I'm afraid not. There are lots of examples of it going the other way round.
Yes.
When you study them all, you realise that there isn't any simple correlation between topography and accent. It's all to do with community groups. I mean, if we go back to the very beginning, 50,000, 100,000 years ago, imagine this, folks. You're in your cave, and you hear a voice outside, and you say in your primitive language, "Who's there?" Now, if the voice that comes back is one you recognize, in other words, it has the same accent, then you say, "Ah, come on in, come on in." But if the voice you hear is not got your accent, you better go outside with your club ready in case they're going to take over your cave. And so, you see, accents have a kind of evolutionary thing. You know, people say the survival of the fittest. Well, accents are the survival of the linguistically fittest. If you're good at accents, you're likely to live.
There you go, because you know these people who can be sometimes annoying, they're sort of chameleon-like when it comes to accents. They go off on holidays to America for 2 weeks and come back with an American accent.
Yeah, that happens. That happens to everybody in some shape or form. Some more than others. It's in my business, it's technically called accommodation. You accommodate to the accent that you're talking to in two different ways. One way, if you like the person you're talking to, you'll pick up some of their habits and start to talk like them. If you don't like the person you're talking to, you go the other way and you make your own accent as different as possible from the one that you're talking to.
So is that some sort of mirroring then?
Yeah, it is. Mirroring. It is. Right. Yeah, and you see it also not just in accent, but in the way you hold your face and the way you hold your body and everything. It's a fascinating thing.
And you were saying, because I maybe didn't say it here, but I was watching a number of interviews you did, that because the English language is the most widespread language in the world, that it hoovers up influences from every other language.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it's always done. Right from the very beginning, a thousand years ago, people were already borrowing words. But it was because English went around the world. You know, we're talking the British Empire now and things like that, or the American Empire, whatever you want to call it. And because people went around the world so much, every culture that they came into contact with brought hundreds, sometimes thousands of words into English. So much so that many of the words that we have now, we don't know where they came from. But we took in not just the word, you see, to go back to your point at the beginning, Ray, we took in the spelling as well. So that a word like guitar, for instance, the thing that you play, what a weird spelling is that?
G-U-I-T-A-R. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, that's right. It's because of where it came from, you see, from Spanish and so on.
Yeah, it's odd. Years ago, I was working a job and we were indexing parish registers.
Yeah.
And we came across this spelling of a name, X-T-Y.
Yes.
And we couldn't figure out. It was a Christian name, you know, a first name.
Oh, yeah.
And we couldn't figure out, and we were going...
Christy.
Yes, there you go. And it was only because we maybe discovered it during the summer. And then somebody, when it came to Christmas, Xmas, somebody then made the thing.
That's it. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you mentioned proper names. They're the worst. At least with everyday words, like the ones we were talking about before, there's a sort of logic there. But the name of a person or the name of a place, you can spell that almost in any way on God's earth, and it doesn't have any logic at all. I mean, one of my daughters, for example, a few years ago, used to live in a little Norfolk village on the coast. Now, it's spelt Happisburg.
Right.
It's pronounced Haysborough.
Yeah.
You see, that sort of thing.
And I'm wondering, David, as we rely less and less on written word, as in handwritten word, because that's what would have happened in those parish registers from the 18th and 19th century. A name just changed because the handwriting of a particular priest might have, misspelt it or something like that, and then that's how it changed.
Absolutely. And this goes right back to the Middle Ages when people did indeed write as they spoke. Uh-huh. And so there was no guarantee that somebody writing in one monastery, say, would write in the same way as another. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why standard English spelling developed in the first place. As long as these little villages and churches and things were on their own without talking to each other, no problem. You know, you spell it the way you like, I'll spell the way I like. We're not going to talk to each other. But as soon as the country unified, became a single nation, then there needed to be a standard spelling. And that's when, of course, things started to get difficult.
How do you feel? Because like, language is about communication.
Yeah.
And communication is about understanding. And
identity, don't forget.
Yeah,
that.
But what I'm getting to here is, you know, you might mispronounce something, but as long as the person who you're talking to understands it, that's fine, I think, you know, because we get caught up with pronunciations and, you know, like back in the day, I wouldn't have got the job I'm doing now because I've a particular accent and accents were frowned upon in broadcasting. Yeah. And it was similar over in the UK. There was a certain way that BBC presenters spoke.
Oh, absolutely, there was. Received pronunciation, it used to be called. You know, received pronunciation, you know, that sort of thing.
And affected, I would say. Affected pronunciation, that's what I would call it.
Yeah, that's right. Or posh, or whatever you like to call it. Yeah. It was certainly an elitist accent.
Yeah.
And for, you know, ever since... You see, the BBC, when it started, had to choose an accent that they thought everybody would respect and the one that was most likely to be understood all over the country. If they went for a regional accent, they felt, you know, so many people wouldn't understand it. And that's the way it was for decades. And then in 1977, there was a huge report in Britain called the Annan Report from Lord Annan. And they made the point, look, we need more regional accents on the BBC. And the reason, you see, was because local radio was developing, local commercial radio in local accents, and the BBC was losing listeners.
Uh-huh. Yes, because you need to be able to identify with the person you're listening to in some way, shape or form, probably.
Yeah, that's right. And so today on the BBC, and it's the same in America, and I guess it's the same in Ireland too, you're hearing much more variation in accents than you ever used to.
What do you feel about AI, or has it impinged on your world at all, and cloning of voices?
Well, not so much yet. It's got a long way to go. I mean, they're doing the best they can, as it were. But, you know, there's a downside to it as well as the upside, and that's got to be watched. It's too soon to say what's going to happen to the language. Certainly as regards the internet as a whole, over the last, you know, 30 years where we have had experience of this, there hasn't been that much influence on the way we talk, or indeed we write. If you look at the way we were writing and talking back in 1990 before the internet came along, and now look at it now, it's not been that much change, really.
But it is a challenge to get the intonation, isn't it, of somebody?
Oh, yeah.
And with that in mind, David, without your permission, I cloned your voice.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. And we have a little quiz.
Which voice did you clone? Because I've had three or four accents already. Right,
well, this is from a talk you gave for the British Council, I'd say, 10 years ago. Okay. So we have a little quiz here, and I would have read the script just before you came on. So I just typed this in with your voice. Do you want to have a listen to it?
Okay.
It's a 1-2-3 quiz. It's here on Radio 1. We have two contestants that get three questions each. It's a general knowledge quiz. After you hear the category for each question, you can decide if you want to go for a one-pointer or a two-pointer.
Gosh, that's very good,
isn't
it, really?
Isn't it very good?
Very, very good, and I wish I was getting the salary that guy was getting.
It is very good, though, isn't it?
And
the thing about it is, like, you didn't say some of those words, you know, ever, probably.
No.
You know, in that order, definitely not.
That's the brilliance of it. You see, there are a group of people called computational linguists, and their job is to, you know, work with the computer guys and make sure that the language input to whatever AI thing is going on is as accurate as possible. And what they do is they analyze the sound system of me in that particular case.
Yeah.
Because remember, there's only about 40 or so vowels and consonants in any one accent in English.
There's only 40.
40-odd, right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, it's 26 letters and about 40-odd sounds.
Right.
And so what they did was they would analyze my, they're called phonemes technically in linguistics, and work out, you know, what all the words in the language would be if I pronounced them.
Right.
And because my vocabulary or your vocabulary isn't more, you know, none of us know the million words. We've all got, you know, 50, 60,000 words at our disposal. And it doesn't take too long. It takes a computer no time at all to go through all those and say, this is how David would have pronounced it.
If he did, yeah. Yeah, we just had our Eurosong selection there the other day. So this is the song that's going to represent us in the Eurovision this year. And oddly, it's a Norwegian singer singing about a Russian dog. And I just thought, because I was in the news, I'd get you just to say the lyric. It's only about 10 seconds long. Just another example of your cloned voice.
You have probably heard about this brave little girl. All we know is that she saved the world. She got sent away, but she wasn't afraid, though she was alone in the dark, big space. Like a party in the sky, like a party in the sky.
That's you there again.
Gosh, I'm a poet and I didn't know
you could do an audiobook with that. You've a lovely, lovely voice. You have a lovely deep timbre to your voice, and you enunciate
and
really
they've
well.
They've picked that up well,
haven't they? Yes,
And the intonation. That's nothing to do with the vowels and consonants we were talking about before. But they've captured that side very, very well.
And you don't do and all that sort of thing. So there's none of those. I've done it with somebody else, and they did the odd mm. And it includes those in the thing, in the cloning.
Yeah. If it was the sort of thing I did, then they would be there,
yes,
certainly.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, this is my life, because I used to do a lot of broadcasting once upon a time. And I remember when I first started, getting told off by my producer for putting too many, they had, do you have this term in Irish broadcasting? De-umming.
Oh, de-umming, right.
You had to de-um something. And they would cut these out and they'd say, David, Dad, we don't want to be de-umming you. Be more fluent. Yeah. And I guess... It came from that, really.
Just a couple of comments here on text, David, before we let you go. Living in Ireland 25 years and haven't lost my London accent yet. When in England, they think my accent is kind of Irish. I'm wondering, and we had this chat upstairs before we came down, we would think in Ireland there are hundreds of different accents and our ears are tuned to them. And they're worlds apart, an inner city Dublin accent and a Kerry accent, worlds apart.
Yeah.
Are they perceived as an Irish accent to everybody else?
Oh, on the whole, yeah. I mean, it depends how familiar you are with the accent world generally. But yes, any of those accents would to somebody who's aware be perceived as Irish. It's only occasionally you get an accent that could come from two very different parts of the world. It does happen occasionally, you know. I mean. But the more distant you are from it, the more difficult you hear the difference.
Yes,
for instance, very few speakers would know the difference between Australian and New Zealand English, for instance.
Yes.
But they are very different, you know.
Yeah, and it's odd. I don't know if you've studied this in all your studies, but people from a place called Waterford in Ireland went to Newfoundland. And to this day, people in Newfoundland have big traces of that Waterford accent.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. They do indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Newfoundland, and I would hear that all the time, and also Nova Scotia. A lot of Irish influence there too.
Yeah.
But that's what happens, you see. I mean, the accent travels with people, goes to a new place. Some of the features get picked up and kept, and that's why American English has its R. You know, after all these words. Because that came straight out of the West Country of England.
Right. It's fascinating. So, David Crystal, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
if not me, get an AI robot to do it. Thanks, Ray. All the best.
Listen, we'll send you an email. You email back and we'll get your man. You get your man to do it. Thanks, David.
Okay.
Have a good day. See you. Bye. Bye. Bye.
And you. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.